This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
You're listening to The West Wing Weekly. My name is Hrishikesh Hirway.
And mine is Joshua Molina.
And the name of this episode is Process Stories. It's Season 4, Episode 8.
It aired first on November 13th, 2002, the teleplay is by Aaron Sorkin, the story by Paula Yu and Lauren Schmidt. Lauren, a name that will be revisited in the series. And this episode was directed by Christopher Misiano.
Process Stories follows directly after the previous episode, Election Night. In this episode, we see Jack Reese moving into his office in the White House, and we learn that Andy Wyatt is actually hoping for a fight over her pregnancy with conservative factions of the country. Plus, there's a coup in Venezuela, and Sam Seaborn decides what he's going to do in the race for the California 47th. Later on in this episode, we'll be joined by the delightful Joanna Gleason, who played Jordan Kendall. This is her last episode as Jordan Kendall.
She's the best. I'm very sorry to see her character go.
Yeah.
What do you think? Do you like this episode?
I do like this episode. I really love episodes that work like this, where they follow directly on the heels of the last episode, where one episode ends and the next episode starts and it's just continuous.
I like that too, especially today in the day, in the era of Netflix, when you can just watch it as essentially one episode.
Right. And I love the way that they introduce that seamlessly by having the end of the previously on segment. There's a round of applause, and it actually carries over as a frontal.
Yes, into a frontal.
Into the title card. So we begin the show with a frontal that's actually audio from the previous episode. I love that.
This entire episode seems to be rife with the potential of coitus. Sex is in the air. Everyone's looking to get some. Am I wrong?
No, you're right. It's also rife with mansplaining.
Hmm. Is there a lot of mansplaining?
It's bookended by some really egregious mansplaining. Starting with Sam explaining
Aristotle's poetics
to Donna in classic form of, let me ask a question and then tell you the answer.
Very Socratic of him.
Right. a little early. Yeah. He's getting all the Greeks in there.
Yeah.
He says,
what he said was this. He said, a probable impossibility is preferable to an improbable possibility. The impossible is preferable to the improbable. What did he mean? He meant it's okay to have a broomstick, sing and dance, but you shouldn't turn on the radio and hear the news report you need to hear.
You want some cake?
No.
I understand his brain is just running on and he's trying to cycle through the possibilities, but it's essentially like Donna might as well not be there.
While we're on it, do we agree with Aristotle? Do we agree with his take on art? Is that true that a probable impossibility is preferable?
Yes.
Why?
Think of it this way. The most extreme versions of the probable impossibility is any version of science fiction, right? Or fantasy, potentially.
Sure, yes.
And all of that stuff is, we're able to suspend our disbelief when watching those. We know that dragons don't exist. We know that there are no hoverboards, things like that. But we can...
Hoversboard.
But we can deal with those impossibilities because in the logic of the show or the movie or whatever we're watching, they seem probable, even though they're impossible. Whereas things that we've objected to, things like... even just recent examples like Cornell Rooker serving on the same Miami City Council as the reporter who talks to CJ with the guy with the magic index card. That is certainly possible, but it seems improbable. And I bumped on that, as did you. And, you know, other coincidences like that where we feel like, all right, or even Will Bailey's story about he's both running the Horton Wild campaign and he also wrote this incredible speech for Gabe Tillman that happens to also have been read on the very same day that people are going to meet Sam Seaborn.
Sure. No, there are plenty of examples and I'm with you. And I complain about the improbable possibility all the time. But aren't there also great works of art? Say the movie Lion.
Mm-hmm.
This little kid gets lost thousands of miles away from home, as an adult, figures out a way to use technology to help him find his way home.
Right.
Possible, highly improbable, great work of art.
But in that example, the reason why it's a great work of art or why the story is so exciting is because of the improbability. The improbability is what the thing hinges on. Whereas this other stuff that we're talking about, these are just points within the dramatic structure that are we're just supposed to accept.
Bottom line, would you have preferred if the kid found his way home on a hoverboard?
My personal preference is improbable impossibilities.
Yes, yeah, fair enough. Okay, I'm with you. I'm glad we worked this out.
Yeah. One little nitpick, though, about this section while Sam rants about Aristotle. He talks about this confluence of events, you know, that has led to this situation that he's in. And he talks about that a few times. And then he says to Toby and CJ,
impressive, though it was an Aristotelian confluence of events that could only happen to me.
And it isn't an Aristotelian confluence of events. It's more like a Homeric confluence of events.
Which is, I think, what motivated the whole Aristotle in the first place, right?
Exactly.
Wasn't he responding to Homer?
And yeah.
Yeah, you're right. I mini-bumped on that when he called it an Aristotelian confluence of events.
I love the word Aristotelian, and I'm all for
it's just fun to say.
Employing it. It's great, great fun to say. It's up there with gubernatorial for me in terms of fun words to say, but I think it's misemployed here.
Well, you know who's going to win the gubernatorial race? The fastest goober.
I'm not.
It's a Lenny and Squiggy joke.
Ah, okay.
but back to what we were talking about. Meanwhile, Aaron really is just using an overly clever technique to point out the improbability of his own storyline.
His own story, exactly.
It's like the smart version of when sometimes people in movies say, oh my God, this is the kind of thing that only happens in movies.
Right. Or someone says this will happen and they say, it's never going to happen. Look, this isn't a movie.
Right.
Yeah. He is kind of covering himself by having one of his characters just express shock.
Right.
I did like the part where he says, if you pitch this to a movie producer, they'd say a probable impossibility is preferable to improbable possibility. And Donna says, that doesn't quite sound like them.
I also, at some point, I wanted someone in that Donna Sam scene to say, the cake is a lie. It felt like it would have been apt.
Cake is a many splendored thing. Flavors of cake.
Indeed.
And I was offended that Sam wouldn't care about his flavors of cake, but I also know that he's a health nut.
That's right.
So
we're talking about Chris Traeger now? Or Rob Lowe?
It's now all bleeding into all
into
three.
Into one.
Speaking of Rob Lowe's other roles, I don't know if you watched the show Orville.
I have not yet. That show perplexes me. I can't tell from the promotions what it is. I thought it was a spoof of like Star Trek shows, but then I watched further promos and it looks like it's just like a Star Trek show.
Yeah, it's actually a little difficult to pin down in a way that I like, in that sometimes it's very silly and very broad and spoofy, and then other times it follows a structure and tone that really mirrors something that you might see on Star Trek, with occasional bursts here and there, little flourishes on the edges that are very silly. So it's kind of neat. I'm actually enjoying how hard it is to pin down.
I'm going to give it a try based on that new information from you.
But in a recent episode, Rob Lowe appeared as a blue alien who has irresistible sex appeal.
This is actually funny. I realize now somebody tweeted that out at me and said, remember how, I think the first time I ever mentioned him on this podcast, I said how meeting him made me feel like I was meeting another species. And somebody tweeted out, oh, he's now playing one on the Orville.
And in both cases, it's about his sex appeal is through the roof.
That's very funny. Speaking of one quick Rob Lowe piece of trivia, it has also been pointed out to me something that I knew and then didn't notice in the rewatch of Game On, which is that in that he gave him the tie scene
right.
at the beach.
Oh,
there's a
yes!
shot of him walking away from me, and it is very clearly a body double.
Right. Do you remember that scene? People pointed that out. I never noticed that before.
Yeah, it's funny that I didn't notice in the rewatch. I know that to be the case. And my memory is, you know, it's a scheduling thing. So for some reason, he had to leave before we finished that last shot of the scene. And so they had someone else who's not particularly built like Rob Lowe walk away. We should put up a still on our website.
Right. Do you remember who that was?
I do not.
Would it have been the Rob Lowe stand-in?
I guess so, yeah.
I'm surprised that his stand-in would look so dissimilar to him.
Yeah, actually, I'm glad that we got onto the subject of stands-in, because my stand-in for, I think, my entire tenure on the West Wing is seen very clearly on camera in this episode. His name is Lee Ferranda. Great guy. Couldn't have been a nicer, sweet guy. And when you're looking for a stand-in for someone, usually you want someone to be really exactly the same height or as close as possible. Sometimes stand-ins have to stand in for multiple actors, just budget-wise. But you want somebody who has a similar complexion, similar color hair, and the same height, roughly, so that they can light the scene without the actors themselves, because it's important to go back and play video games in your trailer and have people bring you cold beverages. So most of the time, a stand-in will have a similar look and build to the person, but it seems not to have been the case, at least for that one scene with Rob.
So tell me about Lee Ferranda in this episode. Where can we see him?
There's a scene when Sam Seaborn steps into kind of the main office, it's like the bullpen, to watch the newscast saying that Horton Wilde seems to be winning the race.
Right at the beginning of the episode.
Yeah, and just kind of behind him off his shoulder is Lee. And well, I'll put up a still of that.
I see that Lee actually has a credit as an aide in the episode Enemies Foreign and Domestic.
Yeah, I noticed that too. This is a nice thing about certain productions. The people who stand in on television shows and movies generally are actors. And often very good actors. And it's nice when they are given an opportunity occasionally when a role comes up that might be suitable to step in front of the camera. And that happens a fair amount on Scandal and happened occasionally on The West Wing.
That's very cool. Maybe he can sub in for you on this podcast if there's ever an episode that you can't make.
Absolutely. Some listeners are disappointed that Rob Lowe is not going to do the next 3.5 seasons of the podcast with you.
Or at least maybe we can get Lee to test your levels.
Yes, that would be nice.
Before we start recording.
One weird moment in the cold open is a piece of one of the newscasters is talking about the election and the importance of the debate in the election and turning it around and the numbers.
Right.
And he uses the phrase,
based on the debates, and 69
plural. Ah, which is odd.
Yeah.
It's, I guess it's just a little mini gaffe.
That is odd.
As there was only one. This cold open typified, I think, what I like most in colds open. The button, I feel, into the swell of Snuffy's opening credits theme has to make you want to say, those guys. I think those are the most effective colds open, and this is one of them.
Toby, is the president endorsing Sam? Is the president endorsing Sam?
I don't know, he's asleep. But let's go ask him.
All right.
It's effective when you're like, ah.
You want a sad trombone into your uplifting oboes.
Then also just sort of like, oh, these guys are such friends. These knuckleheads. I love them.
How would you feel if after Sam said, all right, it went into I'll Be There for You by the Rembrandts?
Yeah, that would work for me. I would clap along at the appropriate moment.
Speaking now, many minutes later, speaking of other credits from actors on the West Wing, we get two cheeky, in my mind, cheeky mentions of the Badlands.
I won the Dakotas. The Badlands, the Black Hills.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I see. I didn't think of that as a nod to Martin Sheen.
I thought it was, I mean, there's no reason to say Badlands. They could have mentioned any geographic part of the country that might be unlikely to vote for a Democratic candidate. Feels a little gratuitous. And then we get another mention of the Badlands from Bruno later when he's trying to flirt.
The Badlands.
Nice.
And I thought that there's no way that's a coincidence. That has to be a nice little nod to Martin Sheen, young baby-faced Martin Sheen.
Indeed.
In his role in the Terrence Malick classic.
Good movie. Very good movie.
We'll put up a picture of Martin Sheen on the website at age 33 in Badlands. It's great. He looks like his sons.
Yeah.
He looks great. I love that movie. Martin Sheen at 33 looks pretty sexy.
He was a sexy mofo in his day. And he's aging well, if I might comment.
Certainly he's bringing in the sexiest Bartlett version of the president that we've seen so far.
Who's your commander-in-chief?
You are.
Yes.
I love when Sam finally does approach the president and interrupts his potential encounter with the first lady.
Mm-hmm.
The president says,
look, man, is everything all right?
He calls Sam man.
Right.
I love it.
Ha.
It feels both unusual and not out of character. like, I really believe that this is something that he would say. And it also, like, jumps out as something I don't think I've ever heard him say. Like, you know, he doesn't often call people
feels
man.
Authentic, though.
Yeah. I also like at the end of that when Sam is leaving the room and he says, kind of conspiratorially,
"This Dean Martin?
Yeah. Good. Thank you."
I like "eyes front, mister."
Yes. I'm glad they used that correctly and not "eye fronts," which some people think.
Indeed. And I like that in his preparation of what appears to be a martini, he dabs just a little bit of gin behind each ear.
I do like that too. Toby gets a nice kiss from Andy.
Yes, he does.
There are two kisses that are a little bit heartbreaking in this episode. There's this kiss from Andy and
exes, yeah. I know where you're going for the other one.
And then Amy gives a kiss to Josh, and both of those are a little heartbreaking.
Ah, those crazy kids, they just can't work it out.
But Andy, it turns out, has some reason for not wanting to get back together with Toby that has absolutely nothing to do with anything about Toby. I mean, she has reasons that have to do with Toby as well, but in this moment, her refusal to get married to him, we discover, has political motivations as well.
You mean because she wants to deal with the controversy?
Yes. She's inviting the controversy of not from her own constituencies, but from anyone who might have some issue with an unwed congresswoman giving birth.
Right. Now, but where do you get that that's why she doesn't want to remarry Toby?
Well, I think that that's because Toby says,
"You're sniffing around for a fight."
Yes.
Not sniffing around for one as much as trying to create one, trying to create trouble where none existed.
And so in order to incite the fight, she has to be a single mom.
Whew, that is a big old reach to me.
Really? When he says trying to create a fight, how is she trying to create trouble where none existed if not?
By not trying to address in any of the ways that he's suggesting the potential controversy of the situation. I mean, I don't get any, she would like to get back together with him.
Well, that's what I say. I'm not sure that that's not her only reason for not getting back with
him. I don't think that's any part of it.
Okay.
Well, I mean, otherwise I think she'd be saying, you know, I love you deeply and would love to get back together, but that's going to have to wait until after I'm done creating this controversy by not getting together with you.
Well, she's also already stated to him that she doesn't want to get married to him. She's like, why not? And she says,
I have the unique experience of having done it once before. Yes.
But here it goes deeper. It's not just that.
You sound like this is, I feel like this is what Toby might say. She really loves me, but now I realize why she does. It's really.
Possibly.
Yeah, I don't think it has anything to do with maybe the fight she's looking for a bit.
Yeah, that's possible. But I wanted to talk about was this moment where she gives him the kiss.
My man got the president reelected tonight.
It's sweet that she calls him my man.
Is it?
Or you think it's mean to
a little
Toby
bit.
Because,
yeah. Well, I mean, when she kisses him, I guess it's sweet, but it's also, he's like, that was pleasant. I don't know. It's just like giving a little, maybe a little manipulative. Or
stringing him along a little.
I think a little.
It's tough. It's hard. I mean, I could imagine from her point of view, she's saying, I'm being completely upfront with my intentions, but I, you know, I clearly am very fond of this man and he is my man, but yeah, it's tough. But what I really wanted to talk about was that line.
That was very pleasant.
His response is so great. It reminded me a little bit of when you say, that is funny. That is funny out loud.
I was just about to say, it's a tiffle moment.
I wrote twiffpull.
There you go.
That was very pleasant out loud.
That's exactly what that was.
I also felt like Andy has a superpower, similar to Will Bailey's superpower ability to summon rain at will.
Sure.
She has the ability to summon the word Maryland from large groups of people at will.
Maryland!
Maryland!
That's actually a great moment, the way she does it.
It is. It's a very limited superpower.
Yes.
But useful in this context. Did you ever see Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog?
Yes.
In that show, Simon Helberg from Big Bang Theory plays a character who can moisten things. It's a little like that.
Brilliant. I just wrote down a lot of men trying to get laid based on election results.
You should vote yes to going to bed with me.
Something like that, yes. And a lot of loose lips about a potential coup in Venezuela.
Yeah.
Both Leo and Captain Jack Reese seem to be a bit loosey-goosey with what I would think would be highly classified information.
Right. I had a question about Jack Reese's behavior overall.
Sure.
He's the watch commander, and at one point, Donna invites him to the party. He's like,
they'll page me up at the party, right?
That seems like I don't know really what the etiquette is for when you're watch commander of a post, but I feel like you should be watching, not relying on people to get in touch with you if something goes wrong.
Or at the very least, maybe this is like the third day on the job behavior.
Right. Not this is sixth his hour.
First, right. Few hours on the job. He's like, eh, good.
Yeah. I don't know if that speaks to the power that Donna has over him or his just incredible crappiness at his job.
What an improbable possibility that the person with whom she swapped votes is coming to work in her workspace.
Yep. A scene that I like, and I don't mean a scene as in Act 1, Scene 2, but just I like the setting of this. I like the setup of it, is the scene in CJ's office where everyone is piled into couches and chairs watching the TV.
Yes.
Where you've got Bonnie and Ginger and Ed and Larry and Carol all together. It's very cozy and collegial. Just to me, it reminds me of what I want most from the holidays. The reason why I like holidays is because it affords me a chance to be in a group setting like this.
Sure.
I would do this every weekend if possible, where it's just a bunch of people piled in couches, you know, flopped around in various positions of lounging, watching something together and like having fun. That is the dream for me.
I'm with you. I love that. And I did get that vibe. And I thought it was a great piece of group acting. There are 9 or 10 actors in there whose work we've enjoyed that don't really speak during that scene. Mm-hmm. But what they are doing is very credibly helping create the atmosphere that you just described. And it's good acting. Partial credit must go to Allison Janney, who creates that kind of vibe around her wherever she goes. And I think we've touched on this before, that her trailer was, I think, the Flamingo Lounge. And it had a similar lighting scheme, and drinks were poured, and there was always good music playing. And Allison creates that feeling around her. And this also reminds me, too, of something that a couple people have pointed out. In the Game On episode, we see the debate, and there are a couple just quick glimpses of Hoynes and Stackhouse.
Yes, yeah, just right? Hanging out.
Yeah, of Tim Matheson and George Coe. It's fantastic because it just, of course they would be around.
Right.
But it means that those two actors, Tim Matheson and George Coe, came in and were willing to be background artists for a day or for however many hours it took to shoot that scene. And that's kind of, that happens on a show like The West Wing. That isn't necessarily going to happen on every show.
Right, but it lends so much depth to the credibility of the scene and the production values that, you know, it's almost like when the art department does a really fantastic job to make you feel like you're living in the real place. I'd say that's my platonic ideal of a party.
Nice. Very nice.
There's a little throwaway thing that I love, and now watching the show like this, I appreciate even more deeply as I surgically go through the lines, which is Amy and Josh when she's going to drop off her coat in his office and they're having a conversation and he's talking to her. At a point she just says, "Want me to open your door?" And he actually responds, "I can do it," while then continuing to make his point. Just that little, her annoyance is funny, but then the fact that he says, "I can do it," in a sincere way, I thought that was great.
Yeah, they're very good together, Mary Louise and Brad.
Yeah, their characters' dynamics are so great in this episode when she's his wingman and he's trying to talk to CJ about Sam running, and he goes off and she says,
"This is what you do, you bounce off the subject."
Right.
Which, by the way, was the original title of this podcast.
An apt one it would be.
In this episode, the modesty of Bruno Gianelli in terms of taking credit up front reminded me of another consultant that we've seen from Aaron, William H. Macy's role as Sam Donovan in Sports Night.
Sure.
In both, he presents these sort of outsiders who come in with their facial hair and do their job, and then they want to leave without making a huge show of things or really taking a big curtain call. I like that subtle kind of Sorkinism between those two, this archetype.
Yeah, good catch. I like too. It made me like Bruno more when he was doing his riff. I also recognize in him a certain camaraderie in the, I got paid and that's what I was here for.
Right.
Because I felt like, I'm the acting version of his political consultant.
Right.
Oh, no, I don't need any special hoo-ha or anything. I got paid and that's why I came here. That said, I love the comeuppance scene. I love that it's sticking in CJ's craw that this guy is out there trying to...
CJ's Craig.
Sticking in CJ's Craig that there's a stolen valor issue going on here, politically speaking. And I like how thoroughly she destroys him.
Right. There's another little sports night echo there too. The guy's name is Chris Whitaker. And I thought about how, Aaron loves to reuse names, as we've noted many times.
He does.
And then I thought, after seeing CJ totally castrate that guy, Chris Whitaker has no sex.
Well done.
I wanted to give a shout out to the music editor.
There's great music in this episode.
I wanted to give a shout out to Matthias Weber, the music editor on this episode. There's this little moment following CJ and Bruno's conversation where she leaves the room after he says, you know, I got paid. She leaves the room. The song ends. The light jazz that's playing in the background ends with a... And then sort of in time, her hand hits the door jamb as she exits. It's a nice, you know, you could have played it many different ways. The song didn't have to end there. To have the song end there is clearly like a choice, and it punctuated her hit in a nice way. I liked that choice.
Wow, I want to go back and look at that moment then. Can you shout out the exact time code? It's hard to get an exact time code on Netflix.
It is.
They've got that ball, and you got to stick the cursor somewhere in the ball. Stop me if I'm turning you on.
This is like nerd hot talk.
It's after Bruno says, nice win. And it's just before the 30-minute mark, around 29-something.
Okay. Look for it, people. There's a lot of food in this episode.
Caviar?
Caviar, yes.
Shrimp. Is there non-fishy foods?
There's also some kosher food in the episode. CJ's eating cake. The reason I draw our attention... Well, the cake is mentioned, both mentioned and later seen, and according to... The Chekhov rule about cake is eaten in the third act. There are a couple, I think, moments of consumable continuity gaffes. I'm Jewish, never eaten a shrimp, so maybe I don't know how they work, but I could swear in the scene with Amy. First of all, it's just a funny moment when they're chatting and she's kind of frustrated that she can't get Josh to focus. And then she goes, ooh, shrimp. And she grabs one and she eats it. And I think when you cut back and forth, she has eaten it almost entirely. Then all of a sudden it's kind of there again. I beg you to take another look. I think there's some continuity issues, which is one of the great difficulties of eating during a scene, which is that you don't know, you know, you're going to use bits of different takes when you put a scene together. Mm-hmm. And so if you don't remember exactly how much you've eaten on which line of dialogue, there's the possibility that the shrimp is gone and it's back and now it's half, now it's three quarters. And I think that thing happens again later with CJ, and she's eating the cake and it's little and then it's big, then there's two pieces on her plate, then there's one piece. Maybe I'm just seeing things. It's possible also I was really hungry when I watched the show. But and then also the caviar gave me a lovely opportunity for another discursion into the wacky world of Judaism. Caviar from sturgeon, or as President Bartlett refers to them, sturgeons. I had to look it up. Either apparently is acceptable.
Okay.
The sturgeon is the subject of a machloket, a controversy in the Jewish world. Fish, in order to be kosher, must have fins and scales. And sturgeon, like swordfish, have scales as a young fish and lose them. As a result, Orthodox Jews will not eat sturgeon nor sturgeon caviar, which is a great loss. I'm a huge fan of caviar because I hitch my wagon to the conservative movement and their perspective that both swordfish and sturgeon are kosher.
Hmm. You've canvassed the opinion of many sturgeons general, it sounds like.
Boom! Yes! Tiffle! Anyway, that's all I got from the world of Judaism.
No, that's great. That's an interesting caviar.
Really egging me up. Ruh, Roe.
Should we talk about Roe versus Wade?
Nice. Ooh, if I had a caviar store, I would say this is where your Roe gets weighed before we ring you up. It's brilliant.
The other difficulty I was thinking about with food scenes is the question of whether or not to actually eat the food.
Ah.
I mean, will you fill up in between takes?
Yes, this is a huge, there's a scene in Bullworth in which a few of us are eating Chinese food, and Warren Beatty, the director, wanted us to appear to be famished and to be eating with great relish.
Do they provide relish?
No, no relish at all. But he insisted that we spit out every bite. And I kept saying to Warren, I'm really hungry. Can I just do one take where I eat it? And then I swear I'll still look really hungry on the following takes, and I'll spit it out and I'll keep it. And he insi- to the point he between every take, and he does insane numbers of takes. We do 10, 20, 30, 40 takes sometimes. He kept running over with paper bag and making me spit out in front of him.
So you would stay hungry.
Yes, exactly.
Stay hungry, my friends.
Yes, stay lean, stay hungry.
It reminds me of an episode of Arrested Development where the family goes on a carb-free diet, and then at the end of the episode, they give it up and they're eating all these carbs. But in actuality, of course, the actors are still concerned with their appearance on screen, and they were not excited about eating all those carbs. So just out of the frame line for camera, there are these buckets that they would just spit the food out into as they did take after take.
That's fantastic. I recently had a scandal scene recently where David, my character, is eating egg rolls with Abby, and they had these great Trader Joe's vegetarian egg rolls. So I was like, I am actually going to eat. I needed to take a bite in the scene too. And I think I'm actually going to, I was like, it's just one little piece, like one little bite. That'll be fine. Cause I'm always trying to lose weight too, unsuccessfully. And then it wasn't until the very end when I asked them to give me kind of a count take, how many takes we had done, and this one, and this set of how many takes, that I realized I'd eaten like 27 egg rolls. And then I looked at the calorie count. It was not good. It was not good. It was like, you know, 3 days worth of calories.
That's great.
They're good, though.
One moment back to Chris Whitaker. I liked that he invoked the phrase silver bullet.
I told Leo McGarry that. I said education is the silver bullet.
It's great that he has that, because we've heard characters in our show, you know, we've heard our heroes talk about education being the silver bullet twice now. We've heard Sam say it to Mallory, and we've heard the president say it to Toby. And so this is a real thing. Somehow that little internal phrase managed to be externalized enough that this random, you know, sixth string pollster
picked up on it.
Yeah. Maybe it became a public talking point for them or something like that, but he got to run with it.
Did I miss something? Early on, there's a little repartee between Toby and Andy about how they're going to tell the babies apart at first.
Yes.
And was that all joking because it's a boy and a girl?
No, I think, you know, newborns, you can't really tell.
When it's a boy and a girl?
I imagine he means just, you know, on a day-to-day basis, not...
It's a boy and a girl. Quick peek, you know who's who.
Well, but you're not going to do a quick peek every time.
You're not going to mix up your twins and screw up their lives when one's a boy and one's a girl.
I think you're allowing for the possibility of quick peeks too often.
Early on in the show, Jack Reese's first moments in the sit room, Leo is introducing everyone. He introduces everyone by names, and then he just kind of says, and there's some other people.
Major Carson from South Cam, Adam Hallridge, CIA Venezuela desk. Troop, Assistant Secretary for Latin American Affairs, and some other people.
Some other people, yeah. That's great.
That made me laugh. It just made me think of Gilligan's Island, where the credits were everybody, and the rest, which was just two more cast members. And finally, they made the commitment later in Gilligan's Island, that they would sing The Professor and Marianne, but it used to be and the rest.
Oh, really?
Yes,
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I only know The Professor and Marianne version.
The star and the rest.
Yeah, no, they didn't get there early on. It used to just be and the rest. And I thought,
shocking.
Come on, Leo. Give the professor and Marianne their due.
The professor and Marianne.
Marianne and the professor, both valuable voices inside the sit room.
Indeed.
Marianne, get the popcorn.
I had a question that was just popped into my head watching that scene with President Bartlett mixing those drinks. I wonder, is there an ethical question about the president drinking or drinking too much? Or consider, since it's a 24-hour-a-day job and one could be called upon to make incredibly high-stakes decisions at any moment of any day, can you drink to inebriation when you're the president?
Right. That's an interesting question.
I feel like there's a good premise for a movie, maybe a comedy in there, where, you know, the president's just completely shit-faced and has to make some sort of nuclear war decision or so.
Completely recontextualizes drunk history.
Doesn't it?
Yeah.
Can you take a sleeping pill?
Yeah. I mean, did you have to invoke the 25th Amendment when you do?
Yeah. I wonder.
You know, we talked a little bit in the last episode about this restriction for Sam and potential carpetbagging if he were to run in other places, you know, who says if he loses, he can't run.
Right.
And we talked about Mitt Romney running, you know, as a potential Senate candidate in Utah after having already served as governor of Massachusetts. And I looked up, it turns out there's a senator who back in the day, before we had direct elections for senators, James Shield in the 1800s, he served as senator for both Illinois, Minnesota, and Missouri.
You know, we have a word for that.
Masturbatorium.
Right. really?
Yeah, and there's a page on the senate.gov website about James Shields. We'll put a link to that.
Why not?
Before we take a break and speak to Joanna Gleason, I wanted to point out that I love the way that she says the last line of this episode. Leo asks,
"Will you dance with me?"
"Yes."
The way that she says yes is electric.
And the scenes of them dancing together are lovely and romantic. And I'm so happy for them both.
I know. Electric maybe isn't the right word. Smoky?
Smoky. There you go. That's a Sorkin word.
That's a Whitaker word.
Yeah.
Dana Whitaker gets called Smoky by Peter Krause.
It's a real loss to the show that we don't see Jordan Kendall again. And a real loss for Leo because she brings out a very tender side of him.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad they got at least one dance in.
That's true. Oh, and this is the bookend. The final scene is also the bookended mansplaining scene.
Oh.
Where Leo tells her about process stories and in the end actually says, "And therein endeth the lesson."
Yeah, maybe that's why she never came back. And he says, "I believe the process matters more than the outcome." And that sounds so quaint these days.
And also just not true. I mean, it was quaint, even in the moment that he's saying it, it's not true.
True.
the process certainly matters.
Joanna Gleason, I don't know if you know as an explicit, not a fan of musicals, but Joanna Gleason, in addition to being a marvelous actor, is an exquisite singer and musical performer. Multiple Tony nominee, Tony winner in 1988, I believe, playing the baker's wife in Stephen Sondheim's Into the Woods. She is so great.
Did you ever see her on stage?
Well, I've heard her many times and I've watched her performances, and there is a great filmed version of the stage production of Into the Woods, and she's wonderful in it, and the whole thing is great. And I'll put up a link or two of that.
Mm-hmm.
I saw her on stage on Broadway in a play called Joe Egg in the early or maybe mid 80s, and she was wonderful in that. Sadly, I did not see the original production of Into the Woods. I saw the filmed version. And my wife, Melissa, saw her in Into the Woods, and we're both huge fans.
You know, one thing I didn't realize before we spoke to her is that her husband is Chris Sarandon. One of my favorite roles of Chris Sarandon's is, might not be on the radar for big Chris Sarandon fans, but he provides one of the voices in Princess Nausicaa.
Oh, really?
The Miyazaki film. In the English version of it, he plays a great character called Kuratawa, and he's fantastic. And it just makes me happy that the two of them are a couple. That's one of those discoveries that just gives me a lot of joy. Let's take a quick break now, and when we come back, we'll be joined by the effervescent Joanna Gleason.
And now, back to the show. And we're back. And now I'm delighted to welcome to the podcast, Joanna Gleason.
Your first season, Josh, was Game On?
Game On was my very first episode, yeah. So sixth episode of the fourth season.
Yeah, and that was one of my absolute favorite.
It's a good episode. He's a good writer, that Aaron Sorkin.
And he's a good writer. He left after season four?
Yes, somewhere in the middle of season four. I had just joined, and all of a sudden we were having this meeting, and Aaron and Tommy were telling us they were leaving. Wait a minute.
Right. It's either Melina or me.
Wow. I never thought of that. I don't think I pushed him out. I think there were other factors.
And I also remember that we had a kind of a version of a drinking game when we'd watch the show when it would air, except we used Cheetos instead of booze. And that's every time that Bradley said the word "the," there was always a little kind of pause after it, like an elision, like the thing of da 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 da. If you watch the da da.
Does the U.S. Attorney's Office know about you?
Always with the word the. There's an extra beat in, and then we'd eat a Cheeto.
Oh my gosh.
I haven't noticed that.
Now you will hear nothing but that.
This is going to be a new tradition on the podcast.
Yes, we like to analyze the verbal tics.
Can we adopt that? The West Wing Weekly Cheeto game?
Yes.
You eat a Cheeto and I'll do a shot. No, maybe not.
I don't know. He might be doing it a lot, Josh.
Yeah, you're right. Maybe I'll stick with Cheetos.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Was that just something you did at home, or is that something among the cast that...
Something you really talk about.
Well, too late now.
Which I'm incredibly proud. But I, you know, we're trained. Our ears are trained. And I was an avid follower of the show. Plus, you could take the script and you could cover all the characters' names and read the script. And you would know, because of the way Aaron wrote, who was speaking. The characters had their own voice. They were so distinct. But this was, I think, a Bradley. Maybe this was just like a Brad choice, you know?
Something he brought to it. It's funny that you say that, because Aaron sometimes gets, I think, an unfair rap. Oh, he writes all his characters the same. And it's really not the case. There is maybe something Sorkinian to his dialogue, but he writes pretty distinct, pretty well-developed, and fully formed characters.
Everybody has the rhythm at which they're the most comfortable, even though they're all sprightly, they may be. But when they're not, like when it's Mrs. What's-Her-Hooter-Tooter from Marblehead, or whatever that riff is, just puts me away. There are characters who, for a reason, don't hear the music. That's how he wrote it. That's part of the music. And that's where you know that they're transient and, you know, part of the story. But man, I miss that music. I miss that music.
How did that music come to you? How did you become part of the show?
Just a phone call. And it happened again with the very last episode of the season finale of The Newsroom, too, when I just got a phone call saying, Aaron wants to know, would you do this? And yes. And with West Wing, too, it was just, we want you to play Jordan Elaine Kendall. And I thought, she's named for, in my mind, of course, she's named for Barbara Jordan, great politician, Elaine May, personal heroine, and Kay Kendall, another cinematic, you know, kind of.
Fantastic. I love that.
I wear it. I'm going to just be proud of that.
Yeah. Had you worked with Aaron before that you, it just was a phone call that you.
It was a phone call. It was the, I now have had my passport stamped by Aaron Sorkin. So, you know, if you get it stamped by Sondheim or Mike Nichols, or you know what I'm saying? And that now Aaron Sorkin stamped my passport.
You have an impressive passport.
I do.
Yeah, you really do. And my guess is that Aaron probably was a huge fan of yours, your work in theater.
It's nice to think so. And I had a great time with him. And also, man, your cast, Josh, that cast and those directors, you know, Tommy Schlamme and Vince Misiano and his brother and Chris Misiano. Mm-hmm. Alex Graves. I mean, there were these first-rate, phenomenal directors. And then we can get to John Spencer.
Unless you have something else, Rishi, first?
Yeah, I was wondering if you ever spoke to Aaron about whether or not there was something in particular that he had seen you in that had led to the role?
No, that would have been eerie, because he might have said, no, just a casting person thought he might be. I'm not actually familiar with your...
I don't think that would
better
would have
to
been
leave
the case.
Schrodinger's box unopened.
Right. Exactly. But back to John Spencer.
He tells us about...
Had you worked with him prior to The West Wing?
We never met. And the first extended time we spent together was in the episode where we were in front of the House Committee. And it was a long day. It was a, you know, like a 12-hour day. And we never stopped talking. In fact, Tommy came over and said, what's up with you two? And I said, I think he's coming to our house for Thanksgiving. We never stopped talking for, you know, at least 8 hours.
How much of that was theater talk?
A lot of it was theater talk. A lot of it was life talk. A lot of it was just, I don't know, but when John locked eyes with you, and when John, you know this, he got right to the core, right to the core of you. And when you act with him, I'd had great scene partners and been part of phenomenal casts in the theater. But on television, I really never have had an experience like that, where suddenly you're better and you're not sure what made you better, but it was John.
That's exactly what I was thinking. It's like sometimes you play tennis with somebody who's a lot better than you are, and all of a sudden you're playing better. It kind of it elevates your game.
Yeah, and I went back and I looked at, and I watched Game On, and I watched, I think I watched all the ones I was in, and I realized it really was a kind of work I had never done, because you can have no plans of what you want to sound like or what you want to emphasize or even who you think you are. But you can have endless expectations because everything is there already in John and in the writing. that whatever happens is going to be right. And that's a freedom for an actor to come with no plans.
And would you discover what the ultimate path was in rehearsals? Or was it really sometimes you'd figure it out on a particular take while the cameras were rolling?
I think the thing about it that was the most like theater for me is when the cameras are rolling, that to me is the point of no return. I never imagined to hear the words cut going again. The curtain goes up and it's 8 o'clock and you don't stop till it's, 10:30. Mm-hmm. So rehearsal is great. It's for your marks. It's for the crew. It's for the lighting. It's a kind of general blocking. And then there's that thing that happens when I hear the word action, it's showtime. And you go until you get the story told. I do remember I got to meet Martin Sheen because I never met him. And I had a scene, small scene with him, in which I also say,
"Due respect, Mr. President, this isn't funny."
"Due respect, Miss Kendall. I'm the last person to whom that needs to be pointed out."
I got intimidated. I mean, I really physically, Martin intimidated me, and not actor to actor. It was just, I'm talking to the President of the United States. And John gave me a look like, you don't joke. You don't get jocular with the President of the United States. And I thought, 5 1/4 here. I'm sweating.
What were some of the things that surprised you most about things that ended up on screen?
I think my favorite thing of all that happened to me as an actor was at the end of the House committee hearing, the one where he's pretty much been questioned for hours and hours, is at the end he asks me what I'm doing for dinner, and then I say, fine, and then he says something like,
"You want to do it tomorrow night instead?"
"What's tomorrow night?"
"It's Christmas Eve."
"Okay."
"Okay."
Just the way he said, "It's Christmas Eve," and I saw something happen to my face that I wasn't aware of at the time, which was this kind of, I saw she was a lonely woman, do you know what I mean? And this was a lifeline, and that she is sentimental and doesn't want to be alone Christmas Eve. Somebody took the Venetian blinds and opened a little light came in, and I thought, wow, it surprised me, and then it thrilled me.
That's great.
Huh. That is a special moment.
You feel it while it's happening, but you don't really understand in the context of what the whole day has been, just how necessary that tiny turn is.
Right, well, that's why somebody, when I was first starting out and was about to do my first work on camera, said, just know that the camera reads your mind. So you don't have to try to, communicate those moments all the time. If you just experience the moment and look at the other actor and it's there, it's going to read.
Let your thoughts move around. You know what I'm saying? Don't show me anything. And it's so relaxing when that happens and you're falling. You feel like you're falling and you're in a zone. And then they say cut and you go, no, I want more.
Did you know from the beginning how many episodes you were going to be on for?
No, I think I did 5. I thought it was In-N-Out Burger. I just thought it was going to be,
In-N-Out Burger.
But you guys were so great together. And that's usually what happens to Aaron. He falls in love with an actor. He thinks, I'm going to bring someone in for one episode and something special happens. And you say, I need more.
Yes, I know. And then this wonderful little kind of off-screen love affair, we got to dance, slow dance together, John and I, and the Christmas Eve dinner, and somebody other than they want half your stuff.
History has shown that if you just wait and tell it to a divorce lawyer, you can have half my stuff.
I don't want half your stuff.
You don't know, some of it's good stuff.
Where are we going?
The implication being that there's something going on here. And then, of course, later they replaced me. Aaron was gone, I think, by that time. And
that's true.
I abandoned all hope. But... I guess Aaron saw something and it was good for John. It was, it was probably good for John's character. And man, it was great for me.
It really was. It was I think Leo as a character ends up continually building these walls around him. And you see so many of the characters around him trying to get through them, trying to break through and reach him in a way that lets him know how much they care about him, usually unsuccessfully.
Absolutely. And he's so... Everything is very close to the vest, and also he has the armor, the kind of Leo McGarry armor.
Right.
That when something does resonate, it's like from the last echo in the Grand Canyon. Did I see that? Did I hear that? It's just like, hello, hello. And yet, on John, you see it because he doesn't show you anything. You just know deep down inside he's felt something. And that's, when you work with an actor who's got 900 layers, it's endless discovery, and it is he whom you want to discover.
Still waters.
Yeah. Missed, sorely missed on screen and life. Yeah.
It is sad that Process Stories is the last time we see Jordan Kendall, because it is the moment when the two characters are the most, finally they're dancing, they're slow dancing. She's got a rose. I mean,
they've been doing a dance of sorts around each other for a while, and they finally get to see them dance together.
And then goodbye.
Goodbye, yeah. I appreciate, but I'm also frustrated by how much Aaron subverts our desire for the culmination of happiness for our characters.
Yes, as probably that's the plan all along. But as we were dancing, John said, sing. He said, just sing into my ear, just sing. And so we, as we were rehearsing, and then a couple times, I was humming and singing into his ear. It was very, very sweet.
That's beautiful.
Do you think we can see that on screen? I don't think I noticed that.
I don't think you can. And I, to this moment, I don't remember if it was just as we rehearsed it and we just didn't stop dancing as we were rehearsing. And he said, sing, or if it actually happened. I don't think it would have happened. They would have picked it up on the mic and had to pay residuals to the song.
I love it, though. But that's the kind of thing that even in a rehearsal, well, that could then inform the performance. I love it.
On top of everything, I don't think she was a singer. You know what I mean?
Right.
She did enough.
Yeah. Do you have other memories? Do you remember when you first came on set the first time?
The first tape read was terrifying because you're coming into a world that exists and everybody's so, they know the bones, they know where everything is. So the first table read is terrifying, actually, but fine. And I knew, I don't think Stockard, who's an old friend of mine and dear friend of mine, I don't know if she was there that day. So I really knew nobody else. I'd worked with Tommy Schlamme, and he had directed me in a Tracy Ullman episode and an ER episode.
I worked with him on the Tracy Ullman show, too.
Yeah, fun. So much fun.
Yeah.
Were you living in Los Angeles then, or were you on the East Coast?
No, we had left New York. We were back in Los Angeles. I had been doing lots and lots and lots of television. My, as I referenced, the motherboard died, the pilot light went out. I was feeling kind of, I got to get back east. Where we came back in 2004 and are happy, you know, we've been more productive. And my husband and I, Chris Sarandon, my husband and I are...
Good actor.
Yeah, the best. And we've done Broadway and off-Broadway and movies. And I've now written a movie I'm going to direct. And so just like life really sort of just blossomed again because we're truly metabolically East Coast people.
We do talk about The Princess Bride a lot on this podcast, it seems.
Oh, well, Humperdinck is in the other room.
And has the West Wing traveled with you through your career? Do people come up to you and remember Jordan Kendall?
They do. And right away, I know that these are people that I would have a cup of coffee with, because if that show means something to you, that means something to me about you.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
That's how I feel about our listenership in general. I think it was a really great discovery for me to know how many other West Wing nerds there really were. You know, the kind of people who could understand the very deep love that I have.
Frankly, there's more than nerddom to this layer cake of love, you know, for Aaron's writing and for the West Wing. There's optimism, there's hope, there's critical thinking, there's common sense, there's empathy, there's the willingness to be moved and open, and the willingness to have dialogue.
And inspiration. The number of times that we meet people that say, I'm doing what I'm doing now, whether it's, you know, social work or a government or I'm in a think tank or because of the show, is incredible. People who weren't alive when it first aired, who are just discovering it now or have in the last 10 years or whatever it is.
That's right. So now we have to run for the vacant seat in Orange County, you know, in the...
Exactly.
Indeed.
Yeah.
This is an aside, but I just saw someone announce, a Democrat announced their candidacy for the California 49th over the weekend.
Let's go, go.
I was like, oh, too off. That's in San Diego.
Well, we have to fight the good fights, and we could steal a page or two from the episodes of The West Wing.
Absolutely. I wish more people would.
Yeah. Strange and interesting times, as they say. Yeah. Not less interesting than strange, but...
Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us and for even shouting us out on Twitter so that we knew that you would be open to it.
You know, we take a lot of car trips, my husband and I. We like to drive. So we get in the car and then what's the podcast? And you guys are, first of all, you guys are amazing and detail-oriented and smart and interesting. So it's a pleasure.
That's a lovely thing to say. Thank you so much. And thank you for joining us on the podcast. And thanks to you all for joining us for this episode of The West Wing Weekly. We're calling it. It's a wrap. It's over. There ain't no more. That's all we got. Except to say that I like Toby's brown suit. I found that one last note. Just that there's something perfect, hat tip to Lynn Paolo, about Toby's suit.
Yeah.
He just looks so Toby in it. And that's all I got.
If you've got more, you can let us know on our website, thewestwingweekly.com, or you can tweet at us at West Wing Weekly, or you can post on our Facebook page or on Instagram at The West Wing Weekly. Josh is also on Twitter at Josh Molina. I'm on Twitter at Rishi Hirway.
Rishi, I don't know if you've heard, has another podcast. It's called Song Exploder. It's terrific. Check it out.
My most recent episode is with Lin-Manuel Miranda, which might be of interest to West Wing fans.
And I go straight from the airport to the studio and I grab Anna Villafañe, who is a Broadway actress, and she agrees to do sort of the female vocals for me. And I grab Alex Lacamoire, who is my longtime arranger, to help me figure out rudimentary harmonies that can go on top of the main melody I'd written in Austria. Isabella Marica, Fajardo, Dorado, Hormiguero,
Sumacao, Luquillo. It's almost like praying. And I'll be back on Scandal on January 18th. Join us then.
Thanks so much, as always, to Zach McNeese and Margaret Miller for helping us make our podcast.
Thanks to everyone who has bought a ticket to our West Wing Weekly live events. Pretty much everything sold out in a blink. That's very exciting for Rishi and me.
The West Wing Weekly is a proud member of Radiotopia from PRX, a curated collection of extraordinary, cutting-edge podcasts. And you can learn more about all the shows at radiotopia.fm.
Patronize our sponsors. That helps us. And so does buying merchandise. Go to the westwingweekly.com/merch and buy some West Wing Weekly swag for the person whom you love.
A reminder that a West Wing Weekly lapel pin makes an excellent little gift that you can give to anyone. If you hang stockings up, it's a good stocking stuffer.
Sure, it can help you hang the stocking up. Right. Forget about whether the person likes West Wing Weekly or not. Yeah, stick the thing into the wall. Think of it as an expensive thumbtack. I do.
Okay.
Okay.
What's next?
Radiotopia.